quote from Swami Ram Das from the book God Experience. All these mantras have intrinsic power in them. And when you chant them continuously, they create in you harmonious vibrations. Your disturbed mind becomes calm and serene. Even diseases in the body disappear. Inharmonious vibrations in the body cause ailments. The chanting of the mantra brings in balanced vibrations and removes all distempers. Now, what would you call a distemper?
Like the distemper? Flu or something.
What? Like the flu or something. Well, you're saying that's some type of infection or
something? Distemper is something that dogs get, right?
It's a, it is a disease, yeah, for dogs.
Yeah.
But it has some other overall meaning.
I think maybe it needs
temper. Temper means regular, and dis means irregular or something.
Yeah.
First, it must be applied to control and harmonize the mind. You will be filled with divine harmony. By chanting the mantras, you will see that discordant vibrations give place to harmonious vibrations. Irritability, bad thoughts, distractions, all disappear. Your wild nature is tamed. All selfish desires and instincts are subdued. You become completely changed person. You know, his ashram, they're always doing the Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram mantra, 24 hours around the clock.
Wow.
And his ashram, they have groups that stay in that, right?
Yes.
In Kerala. Wow. You know, he died in 1963, so probably a couple of years, you know, earlier than this. But he wrote some nice books when he was wandering around as a sadhu.
In Search of God.
Yeah. The World is God. Mm. There's another one, God Experience.
Mm-hmm.
But he settled down.
Bhagavan.
What?
He went to see Bhagavan.
Yeah, he had an experience after seeing Bhagavan. Oh. He went up into the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And he meditated. Yeah, he meditated in a cave for like a couple of weeks, just repeating the mantra nonstop.
He was the original tree hugger. He would go and embrace trees.
Well, I mean, it's so ecstatic, you know what I mean, after that.
So he would do the Rama Japa?
Non-stop, yeah. So he's just talking about his own experience here. But, and so then the ashram he started in Kannad Ghat in Kerala.
Mm.
Mostly a beautiful place I had went there. Here's from the Avadhut Gita. The wise declare that there is really only one immutable being. When you relinquish passions, the one remains. The many disappear. And from Jacob Bohm, he was from what country, Jacob Bohm? He's European, right?
Sounds like German, but I don't know.
God, is he the one that he was like an imprinter? He used to carve these blocks for printing. Even in writings, he put these, you know, images in it from him. And he was like a mystic. God has become that which I am and has made me that which he is.
Mm-hmm.
Get in trouble with the early church.
Yeah.
Say so. This is a quote from Pseudo-Dionysus.
Dionysus.
Dionysus, not Dionysus?
Dionysus. He is the god of
Greek.
He's a hedonist.
My name is derived from this, Dionysus.
Oh, yeah?
No. Okay.
Yeah, well, that's what they say.
He was the carouser.
What?
The god of wine, the carouser.
Oh, okay. That's I wonder if I shouldn't tell anybody.
Why?
Why? Yeah. Really?
But this is the pseudo one.
Pseudo Dionysus, right?
I don't know. Somebody's trying to hide their name, I think, right?
Probably.
The reason cannot attain to him or name him or know him, nor can any affirmation or negation be applied to him. He transcends all affirmation as the perfect and unique cause of all things, and all negation by the preeminence of his simple and absolute nature, free from every limitation beyond them all. I don't know. In Plotinus, quote, if, then, a man sees himself become one with the One, he has in himself a likeness of the One. And if he passes out of himself as an image to its archetype, he has reached the end of his journey. This may be called the flight of the alone to the alone. We have all these articles on rebirth. I have this one, Causality and Rebirth by Dr. W. J. Henn Collins, The Middle Way in Clear Words. Then he said, offered with gratitude and respect to the memory of the masters Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, who composed the verses and commentary of the Prasanapada Madhya Makavritti. Then he has I'm not going to read the article, but then he has the poem from T.S. Eliot. He's Cooker. That's what he put as his name. Shall I say it again? In order to arrive there, to arrive where you are, to get from where you are not, you must go by a way wherein there is no ecstasy. In order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way which is the way of ignorance. In order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by the way of dispossession. In order to arrive at what you are not, you must go through the way in which you are not. And what you do not know is the only thing you know, and what you own is what you do not own, and where you are is where you are not. Got that? That is a long article on causality and rebirth. Okay. I'll be Dharma, the Buddhist sort of thing. The Tibetan doctrine of incarnate Buddhas. This is that they take the vow, may I be reborn again and again until all living beings attain salvation. So they don't become.
Yeah. It's not about
that. Well, no, I mentioned about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you say about it?
He said, once you become realized yourself, everything is realized.
Yeah.
You see only the self everywhere. How is it you can say that when it not be real, realize the self until everyone else realizes the self?
Yeah, right. That makes sense. Yeah.
I don't know, maybe they go over this here. Let me see. The Tibetan doctrine of what are commonly called incarnate Buddhas is a development of the general Mahayana doctrine of bodhisattvas. A bodhisattva is one who has overcome the ego but still refrains from waking up into realization of nirvana in order to help other beings on their journey thereto. Indeed, the full bodhisattva vow is not to withdraw from samsara till all animate beings have first been saved. Now, it is not to be supposed that this can be accomplished in one lifetime. Therefore, the vow must imply either survival in a disembodied state or a continual physical reincarnation. The former of these two possibilities is widely envisaged in far eastern Mahayana. For instance, the practice of invoking the name of Amitabha, Chinese, O-mi-to-fu. This is what Nan Lui at his temple. No. We have Chinese temple. It's said to be based on his vow to save all who call upon him and bring them to the Western paradise. It will be apparent how close this doctrinal development brings Mahayana both in theory and practice to theistic religions. Whether monotheistic or, since there are a plurality of bodhisattvas, polytheistic. In Tibet, the possibility of perpetual return is also developed. A bodhisattva who has exerted a beneficent influence within a certain limited sphere, for instance, in control of a certain monastery, may return again and again in human form to continue the same work. Despite technical differences, this is fundamentally equivalent to the Hindu doctrine of avatars and the Christian doctrine of the Son of God. They go about looking for the reincarnation of the Lama in certain monasteries, right? They have a whole technique. When Hindus declare that a certain master is not a saint but an avatar, what they imply doctrinally is that he is not a man struggling upward on the path of return who has at last in this lifetime made the final breakthrough to deliverance, but a being who has voluntarily descended into human form to help others on their upward path. Therefore, he should have no sadhana, no struggle towards enlightenment in this lifetime, but should simply awaken in childhood or at adolescence into the enlightenment which he deliberately discarded for his venture into the stormy seas of samsara to rescue those struggling therein. This also explains why Christians attach so much importance to the tenet that Christ was born without original sin, which means without the obscuration of enlightenment which normally necessitates spiritual effort. Similarly, those of the Maharshi's followers who regard him as an avatar, and they are many, maintain that his brief awakening into enlightenment at the age of 16 was effortless. In parentheses, it may be added that the followers of Ramakrishna have a more difficult case to make of representing him as an avatar, since they have to explain away the long and violent sadhana he made. You know. But they say he made all these different sadhanas so to teach everyone. You know, Muslim, Christian, he went to the tantric, Advaita.
Oh, yeah. A lot of tantric.
Yeah.
Kali.
Oh. It will be seen then that there is nothing unique in the Tibetan doctrine of what are known as incarnate Buddhas. When I refer to technical differences between that and the Hindu doctrine of avatars, what I had in mind was that as soon as the incarnate Buddha quits one mortal tenement, at death, he immediately takes birth in another, which, as it begins to exercise discrimination, recognizes people and objects from his previous life and recollects occurrences, whereas the Hindu avatar is not limited, either in time or space, to immediate environment or his predecessor, or expected to inherit physical memories. The Hebrew doctrine of return, recorded in the Gospel of St. Matthew, as being confirmed by Christ is in this respect similar to the Hindu. It will be recalled that when Christ revealed himself to his disciples, they protested, somewhat puzzled, that the guardians of the law taught that before the Messiah could appear, the prophet Elijah must first return. Jesus confirmed this teaching, but added that Elias had indeed come, but had not been recognized. Then the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Baptist. The doctrine of return, in whichever form one may find it, adds complexity to the general doctrine of reincarnation. What is it that continues from one birth to another, and what is provided anew each time? Obviously, the bodily form is new, but this implies that the temperament and mental aptitudes are also new. In fact, the entire psychosomatic instrument, since both medical science and astrology show that physical, mental, and temperamental traits go together. A man cannot have the physical makeup indicated by one horoscope and the temperament indicated by another. The body of Aries and the disposition of Taurus, and in actual fact, the records show that the successive incarnations of the Dalai Lama, the most conspicuous and therefore the best documented case of such change of incarnation, have differed widely from one another in build and character, physique and temperament. I think China is planning to ordain their own Dalai Lama after this one goes, right?
Yeah.
Maybe they already got him picked out. What?
He said there wouldn't be another one.
Yeah, no, he's saying.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to stop it.
Nothing stops China.
At the other extreme, it is not sufficient to maintain that what it reincarnates is pure being or the self, because that applies to all beings and will leave no differences between a reincarnation of one bodhisattva and another, or of Krishna or Rama, or of Moses and Elias, or indeed between them and any other from assumed, any other form assumed by the oneself. This implies the existence of beings that are not individualized by the ignorance born of desire, as are mortal men, but at the same time are not universalized in oneness with the self that is in nirvana. There is indeed evidence of such on earth in a human state. Those who knew the Maharshi in his lifetime were quite convinced that he was in a state of constant conscious identity with the self, and yet they did differentiate between him and other such conscious manifestations of identity, Shankara, say, or Christ or Buddha. In this separateness and identity, if this separateness and identity can exist with a body, why not without? The Maharshi was quite categorical that there is nothing beyond the state of Jivan Mukta, realized while embodied, nothing more to attain, no difference between the Jivan Mukta and the Vidheya Mukta, realized after death. What more could he possibly attain by death, when identity is realized already? And what could he lose? Only physical modes of apprehension. And these are already felt to be a restriction. So if we can conceive of such a being embodied, why not disembodied? Then why not re-embodied? Okay. This is written by Bodhicitta. I think this is another sort of name for Arthur Osborne.
Okay. Bhagavan said in one place,
an avatar is only a manifestation
of one aspect.
Of God.
Yeah.
Where Yani is God.
Everything, yeah.
This is an incarnate abbot explained. So I'm going to clarify it now.
An incarnate abbot, yeah. As opposed to one that doesn't have a body.
Well, one that was before and is again.
Okay.
From a speech by Trungpa Thrukku Rinpoche, given in Roslay Laham. After the death of the previous abbot of Saramung, my monastery, the monk sent a deputation to His Holiness Gwalya Karmapa and head of our particular school of Tibetan Buddhism, asking him whether he could tell them where their abbot had taken birth again, so that they would bring him back among them. Gwalya Karmapa spent several days in meditation and finally gave them the answer that their abbot was a young child living in the village of Giji in a house facing south, that the family had two children and a brown dog. After some difficulty, the monks found the house and the young child, who was myself. I am told that as the monks came in and presented me with a traditional white scarf, I behaved in exactly the right manner, although I had never been taught how. Also that I recognized various objects that had been the possessions of my predecessor, shown to me among others of the same kind. Eventually they were convinced that I was the 11th abbot, Trungpa, and they brought me back to Saramung. Have you ever seen the movie The Little Buddha?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they went looking for the reincarnate.
Yes.
And came to California, or Seattle, Washington. One was an American boy.
Yeah.
And the other, in fact, they in the end, they decided that reincarnated as two people. One girl and maybe in northern India or something, and mm-hmm. or Nepal, and one American boy.
Oh.
And you know, you just can't tell the parent, okay, I'm going to take your child to our monastery. And you
know. This is the one with Keanu Reeves?
Yeah.
Yes.
So that was like a parallel story. They were teaching that little boy about Buddha,
oh,
life.
Yeah.
And the one monk was reading out the book mm-hmm. about Buddha's life. And then it was being shown as a movie, you know, parallel with the whole story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You forgot the whole thing.
I forgot, just remember Keanu Reeves.
I went with Eric to see it, and it was on 71st Street, you know, where me and Eric went to see it. It was at the cinema there. Mm. And about,
I remember they were casting for, I don't know if it was a little bit that they come to schools in Nepal.
Yeah, I think they got a girl from Nepal to play the part of the double incarnated. I guess they can take two bodies.
Yeah,
makes sense.
So the monk, you know, the one monk was going on investigating, somehow he came to the Seattle and somehow recognized the boy, and then he called the chief abbot to come and see. Mm. And he's trying to be very diplomatic about telling the parents, you know what I mean? He doesn't want, you know, because...
parents.
And so he brings the other monk and somehow he sees the parents at a baseball game, the boys playing baseball, and he gets to meet them. And the older monk that he brings to show, and he just comes out and says, oh, just want to inform you that we believe your son is an incarnation of our Tibet. We want to take him back to Tibet. So the other monk, oh, he's just kidding. No, that, you know, he doesn't mean that. Because they're going to throw them out of the house.
Call the cops.
That's a funny thing. Okay. Shortly after I was formally enthroned as abbot, though of course all my duties were performed by an elder monk acting as regent, I was put in the charge of a tutor and continued to see my parents from time to time. I began learning about religion from my tutor, who told me about the life of Gautama the Buddha and about his teachings. At the age of 8, I began my first simple meditation. From then on, I learned more and more about the various meditations of our school. I received instruction from 2 of the great gurus or teachers of Eastern Tibet. One of them, Chenzi Rinpoche, is now in India and is still my guru. Sometimes I lived in the monastery and sometimes away from it in retreat. Every monk of our school spent several years in solitary meditation. During that time, living, sleeping, and eating in one small room. Meditation is really the heart of a monk's life. For in it, he discovers the experiences, the actual truth of the teachings he has before known only intellectually. Some Tibetan monks, you know, they take a vow to stay in one room till death.
Huh?
Not just like that. They have like, there's like these little canals of water, mm-hmm. You know, it's going down, and they have these little caves like, it goes through the caves.
Oh.
And then they go into that little room, like 8x8 or 7x7 or something, the canal's going through, and they seal it, masonry. And they have just a slot in the bottom where they push in food.
Mm-hmm.
And they stay there till death. So when they pull out the food, after a while, if he stops taking it, they realize he must be dead. Then they open it up and remove the body.
Wow.
This is a vow.
Okay.
The best.
Wow.
Serious. What?
That, you know, when they follow that, one child from each family goes into the monastery.
Every child.
And I see, even Swami Narayan has the same cult.
Well, I'm from the same cult.
Yeah.
Well, I'm from a Catholic Irish family.
Uh-huh.
And they used to have tradition, one of the children will go into,
uh-huh.
You know, he'd become a nun or a priest or something.
Oh,
go into
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not my mother, my father's German. You want to fuck my father?
When I was going through the northern part near the monasteries and all, Leh, Ladakh and all that, one of the kids was looking at me and making faces at me. A small kid,
oh, yeah.
And a monk.
It's like Buddhas are going to school.
Yeah.
What?
It's like school, boarding school.
Yeah, a lot of them, they just go and
they
leave. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They do it in Tibet and
in
Nepal.
Nepal also too. Yeah,
yeah,
Buddhists.
Swami Narayan also, if you follow us,
I see the Swami Narayan group.
A lot of poor families in India sent their one of their kids to study the Vedas or something.
The Veda Patasala.
Oh, all Veda students are poor only. They are in the Patasala, they are very poor.
That's a revelation of the free school. There's 28 students there, free.
That's so cute.
Yeah. But it's good to learn the Veda.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they get taken care of very well in the Veda. But
it's
not easy. They get up, they have a very strict routine there.
But in the 28 grams of your brain, how much they learn.
Mm. They read this Grantha script. If they look at the books.
Grantham,
It's not Sanskrit. Not Tamil, it's a specific
Grantham. One of my grandmother's name, my mother knows Grantham. Yeah.
It's a literary language.
Oh,
Like Latin.
Yeah.
Wow.
They use that for reading the Veda.
The books that she
what's it called?
Read
Grantha.
To her, Grantham. Grantham.
Grantham.
And it is the Devi Bhagavatam and all that she read to us was in Grantham. And she was explaining to us, my mother knows.
The same sound as Sanskrit.
Yes. The script is a little different.
It's quite a bit. I know Sanskrit. I looked at these books and it's hard to read. I do not want to speak about the particular techniques of meditation. There are many, and they are adapted to suit the needs of all kinds of individuals. I want rather to speak about the reasons for meditation and its essence. For meditation is not necessarily a matter of sitting cross-legged and motionless for a long period of time. It is something that may be practiced consciously or unconsciously by anyone at any time. You will be able to draw parallels to what I shall say both from the beliefs and practices of other religions and from your own experiences. We are all human beings, and our existence presents similar problems and similar possibilities. As Malarepa, the great sage and poet of Tibet, sang from the tops of the mountains, "I am the goal of every great meditator. I am the meeting place of the faithful. I am the coil of birth, death, and decay." But to begin at the beginning, each one of us may be struck at one time or another by the inadequacy of our way of experiencing the world. We feel that something is missing, that our attempts to explain and to organize our lives and to provide ourselves with an emotional security are doomed to failure, and are indeed in themselves contradictory to the nature of things, that in our simply fulfilling our own desires, we are cheating the universe. Meditation is an attempt to remove those aspects of our natures in which our awareness of life is limited and confined, and to experience a new depth. Upon what does our everyday picture of the world depend? It depends not upon things themselves, but on our reactions to them. We project outwards on things our own hopes and prejudices, and order our separate world accordingly. Meditation is a gradual loss of these private worlds, a realization that our true natures lie hidden in the heart of the universe. It is one of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism that things in themselves are without substance. They are all like flowers springing up suddenly out of nothingness and again withering. The world of things, or the appearance of things, is a kind of puppet show, a masquerade. In itself, it possesses a kind of demonic energy, but it can give no lasting satisfaction to the heart. In meditation, we begin to cross the threshold between appearance and reality. Many of us will have thought like this, but we'll also have experienced how difficult this threshold is to cross. All unconsciously, the world of appearances exercises a certain fascination. Everything in its appearances releases a small charge of energy, and our ignorant minds, feeling dissatisfaction with their existing states, leap to swallow this charge. Thereafter, the imprint of the object remains fixed in the memory, as if the experience was in some way pleasurable. The mind desires a repetition of it. If it was unpleasant, the mind will reject any repetition of it, and a negative force is set up. Meditation consists in seeing the world for precisely what it is. This can be done only when one remains quite unaffected by hatred or desire. Raga and Dvesha. One observes dispassionately one's reaction to things, and gradually the passions of greed and hatred are driven out of one's system. Instead of reaching out after one thing and another, one becomes calmer and more self-possessed. One uses the strength thus released to eliminate gradually distracted and discursive thoughts as they arise, and brings oneself into a state of clear one-pointed awareness. One begins to experience greater freedom and to find room to move about in. One no longer heeds one's hopes and fears, and one lets go the burden of them. Becoming nothing, one becomes everything. And suddenly it may happen that one is left for a moment still, and before one is infinite space, and through one and around one, the reality flows unobstructed, as Malarepa says. As happy as the current of a great river, so is the sage who enjoys the stream of thought. This is possible for everyone. But clearly it requires certain qualities in us, and it requires time to come to fruition. We need first of all to have clearly in our mind what we are trying to do. Our basic assumptions influence us far more than we realize. And we must become thoroughly steeped in the ideas and the attitudes of the spiritual life before we can begin. I had to memorize a large portion of our scriptures and repeat them by heart to my tutor. As well as study, we need determination and integrity. Each one stands before the threshold of eternity, alone with himself. He cannot rely on any created thing. Each one of us can forge a true vessel only out of himself. Others may help us, but in the end, it is we alone who are responsible. Gradually, we have to realize the agony of our mistakes, our failure to understand, and we have to have the courage to come out of prison. Then, beyond this attitude, or beyond this solitude, one thing else is needed. Just as everything in the world of appearances releases a charge of energy, so also does everything in eternity. That energy, indeed, is far stronger because it has been purified of the stain of greed, hatred, and material illusion. The thought is not a thought of anything. It is a thought which in itself is pure energy, passing into and through everything unobstructed. So when we purify our mind, a force is built up from which each one of us can draw, and in the light of which each one can examine himself. In the monasteries and hermitages of Tibet, I could feel this strength in operation, and it was something of which we were all part. If I may be allowed to say so, I feel this atmosphere lacking in the cities and even in many churches of this country. But I hope very much that during our time here together, we may join in making a spirit that some may call new and some may call old, but which is itself, which in itself abides forever. By courtesy, the layman. who must have recorded it? You know? Nice talk.
See, Chinese were Buddhist once upon a time. Now, by any Chinese you go, you say, no God, no religion. So but I don't know how the Dalai Lama will be created, I don't know.
They still have Buddhism there in China.
No, very, very little.
Yeah.
In the large amount. We get all these Asian students, no? No, no religion.
But Bodhidharma from India came to China.
Yeah. But a lot of Buddhists, actually, the Ming Dynasty, the guy came to India too. Thailand, Vietnam, everyone was Buddhist.
Thailand, they have lots of Buddhism.
Also, they practice. Yeah. They changed the Buddha's thing for the four
seasons. And Taiwan also Buddha.
Yeah, that is why they don't get along in China and Taiwan. Yeah. It's sad. Buddhism is good.
Hong Kong has Buddhist temple. Hong Kong.
Yeah.
They're fighting it out now.
We have one in Manhattan and one in upstate. And upstate, you know, all these film stars come. Richard Gere.
It's the upstate one with the huge Buddha.
Yeah. And it's very peaceful there. You go and meditate. It's very nice. Yeah. There was one thing, you know.
Singing bowl.
Where was it?
I gave it to somebody or what?
Singing bowl.
Someone wanted it.
You gave it away.
Someone asked me, could I have it? They said, yeah. I don't know. Who was that? I don't know.
No, I miss it.
Yeah, that is nice.
We gotta give up everything. So.
It's very calming. The meditation, the Buddhist meditations are good. Yeah, really nice.
I guess Bhagwan didn't like it. There's one monastery or temple, Buddhist temple, near the psychiatric hospital.
Yeah, you can see it off the Grand Central. Yeah. I visited there once, and that's Malaysia or something, something like that.
It's nice. Because talk about that psychiatric center. What's going on?
Dennis shows me every time we pass by.
Hey, come on. That is the real world. The world outside is crazy.
That's true.